This is Michael Gibbons appearing from Carson City. This is the time for the oral argument in the Court of Appeals. I'm joined today by Judge Jerry Tao and Judge Bonnie Bulla in Las Vegas. Welcome to counsel. We are continuing on with arguments by remote video. It's been working for the most part. We plan on going back to in-person arguments in June. Thank you for being here today, and Mr. Kemp for taking this case through the pro bono program. We haven't had very many problems doing this by video, but if there is, we'll stop and try and fix it. If not, we'll find alternative means once we had to go to the telephone. Hopefully that's not today. Everything went fine this morning on our two arguments, other than one of the attorneys had a technical problem on his end. As I mentioned, we're in different locations, as I'm sure counsel are. You're probably in your offices. Judge Tao, would you like to say hello from Las Vegas?
No, just to say hi to everybody and to thank you guys for working with us on doing oral arguments this way. I know it's never ideal to do them this way, but it's the best we can do under the circumstances, although there's a light at the end of the tunnel and it looks like things may be opening up pretty soon. But for the time being, I know it's inconvenient for everybody. You know, there may be instances of us talking over you or, you know, glitches or things like that. And, you know, I apologize in advance if any of that and anything like that happens. But we're really looking for the argument, and thank you both.
All right, Judge Bullitt.
Well, welcome. Thank you all so much. Judge Tao and I are on the bench together, so we both have our masks on. If you can't understand something that we're saying, please let us know, and we'll certainly re-ask our questions. I know it's a little hard to tell what we're thinking or whether we're going to jump in and interrupt with a question, but we apologize in advance if we do interrupt you, and just please bear with us. So thank you very much.
Okay. All right, I'll officially call the case then to order. This is case number 80133-COA, which is Fernando Haro III versus Bouchon at the Venetian and Republic Indemnity. It's the time set for the argument. The appellant is represented through his attorney, J.P. Kemp. The respondents through their attorney, Kevin Johnson. And counsel, just say hello or something so we make sure the audio is working fine.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Kevin Johnson.
All right, I heard Mr. Johnson and Mr. Kemp. You might have been muted for a second. Try it again.
Good afternoon. J.P. Kemp for Mr. Haro.
Okay. For some reason, the video isn't tracking the audio exactly precisely, and I don't know why it's off slightly, but nonetheless, I could hear you fine. All right, Mr. Kemp, would you like to reserve any time for a rebuttal argument?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. All right, there are a lot of issues to cover in this case. And so you have your work cut out for you, but Mr. Haro's certainly lucky to have somebody of your experience taking this case through the pro bono program.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Again, I'm J.P. Kemp on behalf of Fernando Haro III, and we're here on judicial review of a workers' compensation appeals officer decision and order that affirmed denial of Mr. Haro's occupational disease claim under NRS Chapter 617, which is the Nevada Occupational Disease Act. His occupational disease, carpal tunnel syndrome, he also has right lateral epicondylitis. That issue we'll talk about later. But essentially, what it was Mr. Haro was working as a baker in the Bouchon Bakery at the Venetian, and his job included several hours a day of hand piping macaron cookies to bake them. He would prepare the shells and then they would fill them as all part of the process. The baking required him to use a pastry bag, and it required repetitive and forceful use of his hands. the issue here today is whether or not the appeals officer committed legal errors or abused her discretion in denying Mr. Haro's claim. Specifically, NRS 233B.135 subsection 3 grants authority to this court on judicial review to set aside an appeals officer's decision and order in whole or in part, or remand the matter for a new hearing or for further proceedings, where the final decision, as we argue here, is prejudicial to the rights of Mr. Haro because it constitutes an error of law or an abuse of discretion, such as being arbitrary or capricious, not supported by substantial evidence on the record. We believe there are legal errors and abuse of discretion involved in this case on the various issues. The number one issue that we see in this case is that the appeals officer committed prejudicial error by applying a presumption against Mr. Haro. Under NRS 617.358 subsection 2, the statute provides that there's a presumption against the claim of a claimant that files the claim after the termination of his or her employment. In this case, Mr. Haro had not been terminated from employment by the time he filed his claim. The claim C-4 form is actually May 3rd of 2016. He submitted a C-1 form to notify the employer of the claim around April 16th, which was the day after he learned that he had carpal tunnel syndrome, which was connected to his work by his doctor. So Mr. Haro was not terminated from his employment until November 30th of 2016. Now, that's about 7 months after he learned that his carpal tunnel syndrome was related, and about 6.5 months after the claim was actually filed. The issue arose because Mr. Haro had been on a medical leave of absence. He claimed that he had stress and had to be out on a medical leave of absence. The employer recognized the leave of absence. Several emails back and forth that we've cited in our brief indicated that he was on a leave of absence, and the employer provided documents, the termination form and testimony from the employer saying that they did keep him employed as long as he had an EEOC charge that was pending. Once the EEOC charge was no longer pending at the end of November, they went ahead and terminated his employment. So during the time that the claim was filed, he was still employed. His employment had not been terminated. And under the plain language of the statute, the presumption can only apply if the employee has been terminated, if the employment has been terminated for any reason. The fact that he was not working because he was on a leave of absence does not engage that statutory presumption. In this case, the appeals officer applied the presumption saying, well, he wasn't working and wasn't getting a paycheck. That's not what the statute says. The plain language of the statute is that he has to be terminated for the presumption to apply. And since he wasn't, it was a legal error, and an egregious legal error, because once you start applying the presumption under that statute, you view all of the other evidence in the case and all of the other proceedings through that prism. And that's important when we talk about things like the last injurious exposure rule, which generally is something that is an affirmative defense for the employer to prove. But in this case, because the presumption was applied, everything was colored and tainted against Mr. Haro to his prejudice. And just like a faulty jury instruction, a materially faulty jury instruction, that type of legal error is prejudicial and should require that the case be reversed or certainly remanded for a whole new hearing. And in this case, that is one of the things that we are requesting, would be remand for a new hearing with a different appeals officer with instructions not to apply this presumption. One of the other principal errors was the denial of the occupational disease claim. Under NRS 616C.098, the C-1 form has language that basically satisfies medical causation for a claim. In this case, Dr. Tan, who is Mr. Haro's primary care doctor in California, signed the C4 form and checked the box indicating yes to the question of whether or not there was industrial causation. He did this based upon Dr. Wassef's reporting, which was corroborated of the diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome based on nerve conduction studies that were done. And in opposition to this, there's absolutely no medical evidence whatsoever to the contrary. Zero. The only medical evidence is supportive of this carpal tunnel syndrome being an occupational disease under NRS Chapter 617.
Mr. Kemp?
The finding of the appeals officer to the contrary is not supported by substantial evidence, therefore is an abuse of discretion and also is an error of law.
Mr. Kemp?
Yes.
What is the purpose of the C1 in terms of the actual hearing in front of the appeals officer? Is it considered to be evidence of the doctor's opinion and the condition and the connection to work?
To clarify, it's the C4 form. The C1 is the one that just notifies the employer that there's an issue. The C4 form is actually the claim form, and that the purpose of that is to file the claim. And so the connection on the C4 form is actually saying that the doctor supports causation, that the job did cause the condition. Either, you know, in an injury case, it would be, you know, some sort of traumatic accident. In an occupational disease case, it's repetitive motion occupational disease, that is related to the employment and therefore should be a valid workers' compensation claim. That's the purpose of the C4 form.
Right. But does it actually does it actually serve as evidence at the hearing of the doctor's opinion?
Yes, it does. Yes, they're admitted in every single case. And it wasn't just that. We also had the corroborative evidence then of Dr. Wassef, who was a board-certified orthopedic hand surgeon, who was basing his diagnosis on nerve conduction studies and also his conversation with Mr. Haro.
You've indicated that there was no counter evidence offered. So are you indicating this essentially, with the form alone, is enough to satisfy the preponderance of the evidence?
Yes, it is. And that's essentially what NRS 616C.098, which is incorporated into Chapter 617 by 617.015, which incorporates all of the 616A through 616D statutes to the extent they're not in conflict with Chapter 617. So what that statute says is that language on the C4 form is the same thing as saying to degree of medical probability the accident or the occupational disease was caused by the employment. So therefore it would be sufficient by itself.
What if the appeals officer for some reason doesn't believe it? For example, if the appeals officer thought the worker gave wrong or incorrect or inadequate, incomplete information to the doctor?
Well, and I'd like to address that question by referring to the specific facts of this case. In this case, Mr. Haro estimated that he did 2,000 to 5,000 of these macaroons a day. The employer said it was more like 1,000 or 1,100. And the appeals officer did credit the employer's estimate, basically said, I don't believe Mr. Haro's estimate, I believe the employer's estimate. And so under that set of circumstances, Your Honor, in this particular case, there should have been a medical question found, because the question becomes, is 1,000 or 1,100 of these a day still enough to establish or to cause carpal tunnel syndrome? And it was an abuse of discretion not to raise that medical question, because Mr. Haro goes to the hearing. The employer provides this other evidence. He never gets a chance, basically, to have a doctor address it. And so the answer to the question is that if the appeals officer, you know, doesn't believe that it happened, I mean, that's another issue. But in this particular case, there was no dispute that he was doing 1,000 to 1,100 of these a day. And with the forceful hand, the requirements for the forceful hand usage, that raises a medical question under NRS 616C.360, subsection 3, and it should have gone to an independent medical exam or another doctor to look at it and make that determination, particularly in this case where Mr. I'm sorry.
All right, Mr. Kemp, was there anything that the other side, the employer, presented that said if you had 1,000 a day and not 3,000, 4,000 or more, a person wouldn't get carpal tunnel? In other words, 1,000, what is the significance of that? Do you even have to worry about the medical question if there's nothing that says 1,000 is inadequate to cause carpal tunnel?
There was no evidence to say that that wouldn't be sufficient to cause carpal tunnel syndrome. You'd have to, that's a medical question. You'd have to have a doctor to determine, would doing this type of movement that many times a day be sufficient to cause the carpal tunnel syndrome, and was it in this case? There was no evidence to say that it couldn't, no competent evidence. You'd really have to have expert testimony to say that it couldn't be caused by that.
So in other words, Mr. Haro might have been impeached, or the appeals officer might have thought there was less to his testimony, but there was nothing that actually led to a causation decision other than the doctor's opinion that it was caused. And the doctor certainly didn't quantify it, that if you had 4,000, you'd have it, and if you had 1,000, you would not.
That's correct. And that's why there's a medical question here. And it's also really important to note that Mr. Haro repeatedly was in contact with the employer to get referred to a workers' comp doctor in Nevada, and they stonewalled him, refused to give him that information. He finally had to go with his doctors in California. And that's a violation of NRS 616C.085, which requires the employer to assist the employee in making their claims and getting the medical treatment. That didn't happen here, and that plays into this, because a Nevada workers' compensation doctor should have been consulted on this issue if there was a question about causation to the appeals officer.
Can you address the last injurious rule in 20 seconds?
In 20 seconds, last injurious exposure rule is an affirmative defense that the employer would have to prove. They had no evidence to prove it whatsoever. They had no evidence of what his duties were at his subsequent employment at the Mexican restaurant. We do know that he was not piping macarons, and with no medical evidence and no evidence of what the actual duties were. And also, last injurious exposure rule, it's to decide which of two employers is going to be responsible. The answer can't be that no employers are, because the Mexican restaurant wasn't brought in here to provide evidence. And so there was no substantial evidence to support that the last injurious exposure rule excused Bouchon from, and its insurer, from responsibility for this occupational disease.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kemp. I cut into your time quite a bit with my questions, but you still have a minute left for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I'll reserve then.
All right, Mr. Johnson, you may proceed with the respondent's argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Kevin Johnson, and I, may it please the court, I'm representing Bouchon at the Venetian and Republic Indemnity, the respondents in this case. I think it's important to remember that we're bound by the provisions of NRS 233B135, subparagraph 1B, that indicates that cases are to be decided by the record before the court. We've heard some references here to a DIR allegation of the claimant that's pending elsewhere, which I don't, you know, about the employer's obligations for an out-of-state claim. I don't think that has any relevancy here. However, I'm just going to go right to the rebuttable presumption indication. That is under 617.358, subparagraph 2. That indicates if the employee files a notice of an occupational disease after his or her employment has been terminated for any reason, there is a rebuttable presumption that the occupational disease did not arise out of and in the course of employment. Here we have two claims. The second claim was submitted on December 8th of 2016. And no matter what day of last employment is used, that's after the employment of the claimant. So certainly for the right epicondylitis claim, the rebuttable presumption is appropriate.
And that's Mr. Johnson, let me ask you a quick question on that, because even though it wasn't stated on the original C-4 form, Dr. Wofsuff's letter was attached, which did indicate that there were two related injuries, the carpal tunnel and the epicondylitis. So does it actually have to be spelled out on the form, or was the employer on notice?
I think so. The C4 form itself for the first claim simply had the bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome and nothing else, and there was nothing else diagnosed on that claim.
But my question is, the letter of Dr. Wofsuff was attached, which does address both. Are you saying it actually has to be identified on the form itself?
I believe to keep the employer on notice that there's an actual claim for that. The C4 form itself only indicated that there was a bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome.
Okay, but on the C1 form, which is the notice to the employer, it did indicate that he was experiencing pain in the elbows, correct?
It did indicate that there was pain to the elbows, but it didn't. He also indicated on the C4 form itself on page 595 that it was to the bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome. That's the only thing that he, which matched what the doctor said on the same form. So we believe that that's sufficient to say that that's what the claim was all about, and there was no indication of any other problem. My pages like 600, where he filled out a claim questionnaire of the record on appeal, he indicated that he needed to have surgery on both hands. He never mentioned the elbow. He never mentioned that in his answers to interrogatories either, as I understand it.
Well, I'm not saying as a practical matter it makes a difference, because the surgery was related to the carpal tunnel. So I'm not sure
correct. How
impressive the other injury is in terms of the compensation. But I suppose my inquiry is, does it have to be spelled out on the form, or was it sufficient that Dr. Wofsuff addressed both problems in the letter attached?
In my opinion, you have to spell out exactly what your problem is, and on the C4 form it said bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome, and only referred to symptoms of pain in the other body parts. I believe the entire right upper extremity was mentioned. So that's something we run into a lot. There's a difference between symptomatology versus an actual diagnosis, and the only diagnosis we had was the bilateral carpal tunnel diagnosis.
And you're not saying that that diagnosis was untimely submitted to the employer. It's the second diagnosis.
No, right. I don't think the appeals officer made a finding of any kind of untimely reporting. What she did find was that there was an untimely claim filing that didn't occur for the bilateral or for the right epicondylitis till December of 2016, which you have 90 days from the date of knowledge of the injury and its relationship to the industrial claim, 617-44.
Right, but the carpal tunnel injury was timely identified to the employer.
It was timely filed, yes, and I believe that there's no reporting issue in this one on those either. As far as to when the employment ends, I would ask that you look at the answer to interrogatory that the claimant himself gave. At page 555 of the record on appeal, he said his last day of employment with Bouchon was April 1st, 2015. And in that claim questionnaire I just mentioned on page 598, he also said that his wages stopped on April 2nd, 2015. And there was a follow-up also, was lodging or other advantage furnished directly during the disability? And he answered no. And page 601, he also, on the same claim questionnaire form, indicated that his employment ended on April 2nd, 2015. I believe, and he indicated in his testimony as well, that his last day of employment was April 1st, 2015. That's at the Record on Appeal, page 182. And I think we really kind of had a red herring here as to whether or not the rebuttable presumption applies or not. In the letter that the appeals officer sent out delineating her findings of fact, dated April 6th, 2018, at Record on Appeal at pages 100 and 101, the appeal officer said this: even if the rebuttable is not part of the quote, but it is clearly concerning the rebuttable presumption. Even if the rebuttable presumption did not apply, I nevertheless find that Mr. Harrow has not established that his bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome arose out of and in the course of his employment with Bouchon. My decision is based on the totality of the evidence, too many inconsistencies between Mr. Harrow's testimony and the written evidence presented. Specifically, I did not find Mr. Harrow's testimony and other reporting regarding his job duties to be credible. Claimant has not met his burden under 617.358. And if you look at 617.358, under the first section there, it is the claimant's responsibility to meet the burden of proof. Here we have a history that was given by Mr. Harrell that greatly it was of great difference than what was actually found in the hearing. And in fact, we would ask that you look at the second supplemental evidence packet that we presented. That's at pages 383 to 396 of the Record on Appeal. And those provisions, clearly, we have the claimants, what he's representing to be the case, and then what the employer has said and the margins as to differences in what he's saying is his job consisted of, and not only to the volume of the macaron piping, but there was a tendency that this gentleman worked for Bouchon for only 4 months in that position. Three and a half to four months.
So let me ask you about this. So the appeals officer found that Mr. Harrow was terminated at the time. So here's my question to you. The statute doesn't have its own definition of termination, but termination is a common law term that goes back hundreds of years. In fact, Blackstone uses it. And the rule of statutory interpretation is that legislature legislates against a common law background, and statutes in derogation of the common law are strictly construed, meaning we presume that the legislature adopted the common law terms. So my question to you is, under Nevada employment law, would he have been terminated under these facts?
I'm really not one that can give an answer to that. My response, because I'm really not familiar with the employment law. But in this case, from my understanding, the only reason he was left on the payroll was due to an ongoing EEOC complaint, and so that he would be, if there was a need for some kind of remedy, he would be there. It's clear, as we indicated through the interrogatory answers, his testimony, his representations everywhere else, that he considered himself to not be an employee. He went out and got another job in May of 2015, just a couple of weeks after a notice was given of this of injuries in this case. So,
but Mr. Johnson, in all fairness, didn't Mr. Harrow also indicate that he was assured by your client that he would still have some sort of employment relationship with Bouchon? And also, if he was in fact terminated, or if he did meet that definition, why did Bouchon send or have documented in its file that he was actually terminated 11/30/16?
It is true, Your Honor, that there is a document that indicates that the formal termination of his employment was 11/30/16. However, there's absolutely no indication in the claimant himself has admitted that he did nothing with the employer after April 1st of 2015. I think it really comes down as the appeals officer has clearly indicated that she found a lot of inconsistencies and problems with Mr. Harrow's testimony as comparison to what the actual work records as far as attendance, which were found in that second supplemental evidence packet that I mentioned.
Mr. Johnson, let me follow up with you with the same questions I asked Mr. Kemp on this. You can have inconsistencies, misstatements, various things, but they have to be material to the issue at hand. If you impeach somebody on a collateral matter, it may not carry the day because the main issue can still apply, and that is you have the doctor's testimony through the documents that say it's work-related. So where is it that the appeals officer specifically found, because of this inconsistency or this part I don't believe, that means the doctor's statement is wrong, therefore I can discount the doctor's statement?
What I think she has done in this case is NRS 617.358.1 puts all of the responsibility and burden of proof on the claimant to prove that there's an actual compensable occupational disease. And with the information that he gave the doctors, that she weighed the evidence and found that there was so many inconsistencies as to how many hours he performed the macaroon piping, for instance. He made that sound like it was an all-day affair where it was only 2 to 3 hours a day. He did have assistants doing it, and he was gone for several weeks of the time frame at issue, or several days, I should say, of the time frame at issue. So I think she took the what was represented to the doctors and said, hey, it's your burden to show that you have a compensable occupational disease, and there's so many inconsistencies and exaggerations as to how hard you had to work, how often you had to work, whether there was people there to help you, and all of that. He represented that he had to do more than that, that he had, I can't remember the proper term, for putting the macaron cookies together, that was his.
Right, but if Bouchon agrees that he did at least 1,000 a day, then where is the connection that says that 1,000 is insufficient? You're simply saying that, well, there's questions about it, so therefore we don't believe him in general, but does that mean we don't believe the doctors either when there's no contrary medical evidence that says, well, if you only have 1,000, you're not going to have carpal tunnel?
Well, the problem is that there isn't even any representation that there was 1,000 a day. That was kind of an average. There are lots of days when it was a lot less, and he was saying that there was like 500% to 250% to 500% of what was actually being performed, and he was the facts of through the employer side of the representation were that he wasn't doing that for many hours a day, and that he was grossly misrepresenting how many he did, period, and that the 1,000 was what the shop itself did, not what Mr. Harrow did. So I believe that at this point in time, we'd be reweighing the evidence, because the appeals officer is simply saying all the evidence before me doesn't come anywhere near what he was representing to the doctors.
Mr. Kemp's preemptive response was that this raises a medical question, and therefore, since I only have the medical evidence going one way, maybe it was bad information to that doctor. We don't know. We should have a medical question answered, and the statutes allow for that.
Again, I think it comes back to who has the burden of showing that they have a medical an occupational disease. That lays with the claimant, not the insurers or not the appeals officer to prove it. And in this case, the appeals officer has found that the claimant simply didn't meet that burden of showing that what he represented to the doctors who found a causal connection was anywhere near what they were finding a causal connection.
Right, but the appeals officer never said that. I mean, that's your spin on it, it sounds like to me. The officer didn't actually put it that way.
I beg to differ, because if you look at the findings of fact, I think she put great weight on all the on the times that the person at Mr. Harrow worked, et cetera, and I would just leave it there.
Oh, Mr. Johnson, I'm going to hold you over just like I did Mr. Kemp. Can you say in 20 seconds why the last injurious exposure rule does apply in this case?
The last injurious exposure rule puts the entire the entire claim on a successive employer. Mr. Harrow worked as a cook, and he helped at a Mexican restaurant. He also worked with an individual doing a large meetings outside. He helped with doing that, and he indicated that his problems didn't even come to bear until after he had been working with those entities, although I understand that they're not piping macarons with those entities. He was cooking using his wrists, moving pans around, and we also have some evidence about him performing some bakery work on his own through social media.
So the criticisms you have with the evidence from Bouchon not being significant enough by the plaintiff, how does the defense show in this situation that what he did in these other activities was somehow connected to carpal tunnel?
Just simply that there was the symptomatology just happened after he was started working there, and he admits that he's working 30 to 40 hours a week. And I know there was some testimony as to if he didn't work that hard, but he was doing fry cooking and helping out with.
Somehow that testimony is enough to invoke the rule, as vague as it is, but the other testimony is not, from what happened at Bouchon, that was repetitive?
Well, we have details as to what happened at Bouchon, as to from the employer's responses to his written, his several pages of written evidence as to what he thought he had done. We have we have response to that, and the employer themselves also responded. And there was a great disparity in the evidence in that case. Whereas the last injurious exposure rule only requires that there be some kind of impact, and we believe that the appeals officer found appropriately there, because that's when he started having the problems, was when he was working at those other places.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Kemp, the time, the extra time I added for the respondent was quite a bit more than 20 seconds. So I'm going to reset your time at 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. One of the things it's important to remember is that these were all estimates. The employer based their estimates on the number of sales of macarons, but their testimony was that there was a lot of waste. And so they would actually make macarons that never got sold because they weren't up to par. They weren't up to snuff. All of the variables in the case that lead to the medical question, how many macarons did he have help? How many hours did he work? How many days did he work? How many days did he miss? And what days off did he have? All of that is something that needs to be considered as part of a medical question to determine whether or not he was still, you know, when he was piping at least 1,000 or 1,100 of these macarons every shift, if that was enough to cause the carpal tunnel syndrome. With respect to the other job that he had, there was nothing in the evidence to show that he was using his hands in a way that was anywhere similar to the industrial scale piping of macarons that he was doing at Bouchon. So there's no evidence, actually, the only evidence of what he was doing at the Mexican restaurant was his own testimony that it was a very easy job and it didn't really impact him. You know, that all comes down to, with the last injurious exposure, whether or not it was a continuation of the carpal tunnel syndrome or if it was a brand new trauma or brand new condition that was caused. I wanted to address the fact that the second claim for the epicondylitis was filed in error. He was told by the insurer that he should file a second claim. He didn't need to do that. This is just an issue of scope of claim. Once a claim is accepted, if the appropriate body parts or conditions aren't included, that can be added in through the litigation process to get those included. He was not terminated. He was on a leave of absence. The employer says so. They continued his medical benefits. He simply was not terminated, and the presumption should never have applied, Your Honors. I'm out of time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Both of you did an excellent job, much appreciated by this court. And again, thank you, Mr. Kemp, for taking this through the pro bono program. Judge Dowd, do you have any concluding comments?
No, just, good argument from both of you. And again, I just want to repeat, thank you, Mr. Kemp, for taking this to the pro bono program. One of the, you know, problems with the criminal justice is, with the judiciary, is there are always more cases and there are lawyers willing to step up to handle them, especially in some of these administrative cases, which aren't, you know, million-dollar cases you're going to get, you know, all the time that you spent, you know, compensated for. So we really appreciate your help in this case, and hopefully both of you will take a case, another case in the future.
Hey, Judge Bullock.
Thank you. We do get CLE now.
Oh, really?
We can get CLE now. Yeah. That's
well, great. There's a motivator. Well, thank you both. Thank you both so much. Oh. Both arguments were excellent and very informative. We sure appreciate you bearing with us through this process, and we look forward to seeing you in person, hopefully, next time. So thank you.
Right. Thank you.
All right, this matter will be taken under submission then for a written decision in the near future. All right, we'll be in